Coming up on Weekend America.
Wherever there are people and politics, there will be protesters.
Your conduct is in violation of state and city law.
This is not free trade.
Plan is to take Seattle and have fun with it.
As delegates and activists gather in Denver, we look at the evolution of protest. I'm John Moe. Meanwhile, over at Barbie's place, there's unrest as well.
This is Skipper.
Yes.
And she's in her original bathing suit. Her hair is really snaggy and gross now. Whoopsie,
her head just fell off.
Okay, nobody panic.
What is revealed playing Barbies in middle age? And tips for letting go of the Olympics.
In a way, the Olympics are kind of every great television show rolled into one.
Except with more trampolines and Latvians. Weekend America, after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
Welcome to the weekend. I'm John Moe in St. Paul. Joe Biden, well, he's in Springfield, Illinois, for his first appearance as Barack Obama's running mate. That announcement came overnight. After Springfield, the two head off on a national campaign tour before arriving in Denver for the convention. Hey, we're traveling the country, too. We're talking to your friends and neighbors. We'll go to New York to learn the latest techniques in teaching a kid to ride a bike from a bike riding instructor. More importantly, we learn that there's such a thing as a bike riding instructor. We also check in with a former Olympian for tips on dealing with post-Olympic letdown. And we check out the new weekend hotspot in Cleveland, cemeteries. They're not just for, you know, what they're normally for anymore. People are having all sorts of fun in the boneyard. What are some alternate uses you can think of for a cemetery?
You could always do the Las Vegas thing and just build a new housing development, although that's got kind of a poltergeisty feel to it.
I'm kind of a hippie, I guess, and I've been thinking about the energy thing a lot lately, so the first thing that came to mind is windmills.
A large cemetery could be used to fly model airplanes or to launch rockets.
A dirt bike track.
Nature walks.
Community garden.
I feel that cemeteries actually should be kind of regarded as public parks.
Late night rave. Probably the number one thing. No one's ever going to be there. Everyone's pretty quiet. And for the most part, it's going to be pretty cheap.
Well, at least everybody's respectful of those who have passed. Dirt bike track? Those voices came from Portland, Oregon, Las Vegas, and Denver.
68 was like an earthquake.
The country was not on the cusp of revolution.
There appeared to be as many policemen as demonstrators.
But it was certainly on the cusp of some enormous millennial change.
We hear you loud and clear, boy.
It still does resonate even when people don't realize that it's resonating.
40 years ago this weekend, the whole world watched as the Democratic National Convention in Chicago descended into chaos. At the 68 convention, members of the Youth International Party, also known as Yippies, planned what they called a Festival of Life, a six-day event that would blend political theatrics, music, and protest, all demanding an end to the Vietnam War. Well, the city of Chicago refused to issue the group permits for the festival, so the group took to the streets. Chaos ruled in Chicago for days while the Democratic Party splintered on the convention floor, and it was all broadcast live to America's living rooms. The 68 protest has had a lasting effect on politics, but it also led to a revolution in protesting. In a minute, we're going to be joined by an expert on the history of protest in America and learn how public safety and control have radically transformed the institution of protest over the last 40 years. But first, let's hear the difference 40 years makes. Here's 40 years of protest in just under 3 minutes.
Into the street. Into the street. Black children. Black children. Moving, moving.
Welcome to the new wave of feminism. Welcome to each other. Welcome home.
This is just one of many rallies held today to signal the beginning of the National Women's Conference.
We have to make changes.
We want to have control over our own bodies and our own destinies. That includes, of course, abortion on demand.
We're talking about abortion. It's against the law.
The Equal Rights Amendment should be ratified.
Reagan, Reagan, he's no good. Take him back to Hollywood.
Solidarity Day was the first evidence that labor was ready to gamble on flat-out opposition to the Reagan program of tax cuts and budget shifts.
Look around you. You are not alone.
Gallant, gallant, ride the pole. Rise above, we're gonna rise above. Make this sport what we say. Rise above, we're gonna rise above.
Act up!
There was the sound of protest over what was called overwhelming red tape in releasing more money to fight AIDS.
If I'm dying from anything, I'm dying from the fact that not enough rich, white, heterosexual men have gotten AIDS for anybody to give it.
About a million people coming together. This is the biggest unity call that's ever been called to the brothers here in North America.
It was the 1 million man march.
Your conduct is in violation of state and city law.
This is not free trade.
Plan is to take Seattle and have fun with it.
It's concentrated corporate power utilizing the governments of the world against us.
Broke windows at the Gap, they're smashing windows at McDonald's, they're dumping over garbage cans.
What I see going on here is a censorship of those rights before we have the chance to exercise those rights.
And your failure to leave the area now will subject you to arrest for failure to disperse.
Today in Boston,
concrete barriers, barbed wire.
It is a disgrace to the First Amendment that protest in some place in this town must take place within a steel cage surrounded by barbed wire.
Push and carry off the wall.
We want to show the world that we are not having it. We are not having another 4 years of George Bush and the Republicans.
People united, we'll all get arrested.
So we've come a long way with protest, but how did we get here? How and why has protest evolved in the way that it has? James Jasper is the author of The Art of Moral Protest, Culture, Biography, and Creativity in Social Movements. He joins us from New York City. And let's start at the top. How is protest different now than in 1968?
Well, protest today is quite a bit better organized. There's a lot of negotiation now with the police in advance. There's a lot of negotiation over permits, over where people can protest without being arrested. We saw this, for example, in New York 4 years ago with the Republican convention. There was a lot of constraints placed on the protesters about where they could march, where they could be. They couldn't be too close to the convention center and so on. So there's a lot of work that goes into a protest beforehand now. And I think people right now are simply less angry, less upset than protesters were in 1968.
Well, then which came first? Are they less upset and so they enter into these, you know, negotiations and kind of a partnership with the police? Or are they less upset because all this planning has taken place?
I think both. More the latter, though. I think people realize now that getting out of hand, having confrontations with the police really doesn't help you much in the long run. In 68, a lot of people really thought that there could be a revolution in this country. When I say a lot of people, I mean a lot of the protesters. It was actually a fairly small proportion of the U.S. population. Now I think a larger proportion of the U.S. population has had experience with protests. They've marched. They've been parts of rallies. So I think they have a more realistic view of what a social movement, a protest movement can do.
So then what does that mean in terms of the goals of a protest now as opposed to in years past?
Well, I think the goals are more moderated now. The purpose of a protest now really is to put pressure on politicians and on people within the system. The purpose is not to break down the system in some way or shut down the system. So I think people want smaller reforms. They want to have a moral voice that's heard. Whether or not anything really does happen, it's very satisfying to take a stand and to show other people that you really care. That's a big part of what protest is about. But you especially want to show politicians that you care, that there's a constituency out there for some position or other.
It sounds a lot like a letter-writing campaign. I mean, it sounds much more genteel in its approach.
It is. Now, this has its limits, of course. Throughout U.S. history, protesters have gotten what they wanted more often when they really shut down an economic system or they block a city and keep it from functioning properly. So moderation has its costs. There's a trade-off there.
What were the big events in the last 40 years that have changed the institution of protest?
Well, there's been, I would say there are two large changes. One has been a kind of normalization of protest, that the police are better trained, so they're less likely to start a kind of fight with protesters. Protesters themselves have been kind of trained to cooperate with the police. So protest is a more normal thing now than it was 40 years ago. We've seen a lot of it in the last 40 years. So that's a big factor. One thing also that has changed is that the right has mobilized, largely in reaction to the events of the 60s. But we've seen a huge organization by the religious right, the anti-abortion movement, a kind of backlash against feminism. So now when you talk about protest movements or protests, it's as likely to be organized by the right as by the left.
What role do you expect protest is going to have in Denver and St. Paul this time around? What are you looking for?
Well, I don't think it's going to get so much media attention, and I don't think it's going to have that much effect on either political party, in part because there's no real choice that either party is facing over who their candidate will be, who their nominee will be. So there are not a lot of issues up for grabs. I don't see any points of leverage where protests could make much of a difference this year.
And how are they being handled in terms of the, we've seen the free speech zones and the caged off areas far away from where the convention is taking place. What will protests look like at these conventions this time?
Well, because of that, it might be quite tame. And if it's not right there at the convention center, it tends not to get as much coverage by the media. So I think the police have learned quite well how to control protest. Now, what this means for the future is that protesters may simply have to find other ways to protest and break out of the kinds of things they've been doing for decades now, which is negotiating with the police, getting the right permits, going where the police tell them to. They may have to become more radical in the future to have an effect and break out of these kinds of constraints.
So do you forecast that we're heading down a more orderly path with protest or a more disorderly path?
I know better than to make very clear predictions of any kind about the future. At some point, someday, protesters are going to figure out how to break out of the orderly path we're going down now. When that will be, I wouldn't want to guess. Over what issue, I wouldn't want to guess. But someday that's going to have to happen.
James Jasper, thanks for talking with us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
And our protest collage was produced by Ann Hepperman and Kara Oler as part of our series This Weekend in 1968.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week.
What does it sound like when two mature, intelligent, confident women play Barbies? How many complicated issues can fit in a Malibu dream house anyway? Next on Weekend America. It's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. The iconic Barbie doll is having a great summer, and I'm not talking about life in her swanky pad or her career as a veterinarian either. I mean in real life. Last week, Barbie won a round in a copyright infringement battle against her modern competitor, the Bratz dolls. Have you seen these things? They're like tiny, squat Barbies, but with huge heads and incredibly thick makeup and big eyes and no noses. Anyway, last month, Mattel issued an Alpha Kappa Alpha Barbie in honor of the nation's oldest black sorority. It's 100 years old this year. Weekend America's Desiree Cooper is an Alpha Kappa Alpha. Can't wait to get her hands on one of those commemorative Barbies. But until then, she'll have to be content to do what millions of girls do every weekend worldwide, play with her old Barbies.
My Barbies have been living in my mother's attic in Virginia for 35 years. She knows how much I love those Barbies. She would never throw them away. So this summer, when she was cleaning out the attic, she packed them up and she mailed them to me in St. Paul. My coworker Nancy Olison was just as excited as I was. Both Nancy and I are 50-ish, about the same age as Barbie. And for us, Barbie wasn't just a doll, but a best friend. Nancy had just come across some of her old Barbies too, and so we made this plan. As soon as my Barbie dolls arrived, we'd hang out at Nancy's house, and we'd open them together. Okay, you know what? I'm going to just scoop them all out of this so that I can have the case.
It smells like the attic.
It smells like 1965.
I'm getting a waft.
Oh, wow. Oh. Look at this. Is this Jackie O?
That is totally Jackie.
The leather.
It's a white
jacket.
Well, you know what? It's not leather.
Oh, my goodness.
And here she is.
Here's
What's
Barbie.
What's her name?
I don't know who she is. I don't remember her name. Oh, that's kind of sad.
This is Skipper.
Yes.
And this is, she's in her original bathing suit. And her hair is really snaggy and gross now. But I remember what it was like when we first got her. Whoopsie,
like
uh-oh, her head just fell off. Okay, off. Okay, nobody panic.
I was mesmerized. All those wedding dresses, evening gowns, purses, shoes. Just to think, we'd grown up to be these educated, career-driven women with daughters of our own, but Barbie still had us under her spell.
Do you want to play Barbies?
I am playing Barbies.
Oh,
as you
okay,
can tell,
okay,
I'm not even listening to you.
Yeah.
You see how her knees snap, you know, like the joints?
Yeah.
I used to like that sound, and you could, like, pose them. All right, so now the Malibu Barbie is got her wedding dress on.
Okay.
And she's on the way to the wedding.
I'm going to grab one more box over here. Check this out. This is not a Barbie product. This is like a
kitchen.
Yes, it's a kitchen. I mean, what I'm saying is it wasn't made by Mattel, but I integrated this into my whole Barbie world. And my Barbies would stand at this kitchen and cook. And here's the little dish rack.
The mixer.
Yeah.
You've got pots and pans, and yeah, you've got whole kernel corn.
I've got it, sister. I've got the stuff. And when I was set up in my full glory, I mean, it was exciting to be over at my house playing Barbies. This is riffraff. I mean, stuff.
Accessories.
Brushes.
Okay, I just found a pair of black silk bloomers with lace.
They're a little promiscuous.
Oh my God. That's craziness. I didn't realize that my Barbie had lingerie
like this. She had Victoria's Secret lingerie. This is something. Yeah.
All right, I have a question for you.
Okay.
Did your Barbie ever kiss Ken?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't. What did your Barbies do?
She definitely fell in love, especially once Ken or Brad was on the scene.
Uh huh.
So, yes, they did kiss.
I think you said that your Barbies got naked.
And my Barbies got naked. You called me out.
Yep. And they went to bed together.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But that's about all that we had it figured out.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was like nap time.
No
clothes off. Nap time.
Clothes off. Nap time. Under the sheets. There you go.
Yeah. 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 They did.
Yeah. I don't remember that my Barbies did that, but I'm not saying for sure that they didn't. My feet are very huge. I have gigantic Nordic flat size 11 feet. But Barbie got to wear the really cool shoes that I can never wear. Sometimes when I look at my feet, I still have a flash of like, my feet are not right. They're not the right feet.
I don't think I had that. You know, for one thing, my first Barbies were white, and I was keenly aware that I was black. So I knew that I wasn't going to one day just wake up and look in the mirror, magic mirror, and I would look like Barbie, really. You know, it kind of broke the illusion, you know, at all, that this was supposed to correlate to me in some way. I just like the cachet of Barbie. Like, I would one day be a beautiful woman with, I would have long hair, I'd have big boobs, mm-hmm. I'd have fabulous clothes, I'd have a Ken, I'd have a car, you know, that it was the cachet of Barbie that I really, really bought into.
Oh, this is my Barbie case.
I was interested in Barbies for about 12 years. I'm still interested in Barbies.
Why?
Because they were my life. And I am living a domestic life that I was practicing when I was a girl. I kid you not. Now, I like to think that I'm living a liberated domestic life, but I'm deeply interested in household activities, and I practiced when I was a girl. And Barbies was just an extension of playing that I did every weekend.
I think that what has sort of been lost in translation is an appreciation of what it means to be a girl. And what it means to be a woman. For me, as I've grown up, I've maybe politicized those things a bit. Dressing up, you know, or going out on a date or whatever. I mean, those are fun, wonderful things about growing up. And those are things that were sort of cherished by the Barbie existence. Mm-hmm. Just to, like, you know, be ferociously pink. And I think Barbie was kind of kept that alive for us.
From Barbie's Dreamland, this is Desiree Cooper.
Weekend America's Desiree Cooper with Nancy Oleson and their Barbies. You have got to see the photos at our website, weekendamerica.org. We've got 11-year-old pouty Des Cooper holding her Barbies. We've got Barbie and Ken in a car on their way to a wedding, but Ken looks a lot like Roy from Siegfried and Roy. Check it out, weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, KPCC Los Angeles, and KUOW Seattle, and is made possible in part by the University of Washington Foster School of Business Executive MBA Program.
Some things you never forget. Like when mom or dad taught you to ride a bike, or when mom and dad hired someone else to teach you to ride a bike. Ahead on Weekend America. From American Public Media, this is Week in America. I'm John Moe, and it's time for your letters. A lot of you wrote to thank us for Karen Williams' story on our show a few weeks ago. She told about her lifelong struggle with severe scarring on her body, and particularly her face, after a childhood bout with chickenpox. She talked about how she came to live with that.
I would have to have a series of injections every other week into my scars. It was torture. And I decided after 5 years of treatments, after 5 years of laying on a table, 5 years of injections, 5 years of photographs, 5 years of being, you know, interviewed for medical journals, I did not want to go through the pain anymore. I will grow into the skin that I'm meant to have, and it will be okay.
Keita Hodgson is a nurse in West Hollywood, California. She called the story one of the most powerful she'd ever heard on the radio.
I felt moved and really deeply ashamed of myself, because I do recoil when I see people whose faces particularly are scarred. And I always feel so horrible about that, because I know that it blocks me from seeing the person that's behind that. And I never know how to move through it. And Karen just talked so openly and so powerfully and bravely about all that she went through. I think that the next time that I'm faced with a situation like that, that I will be able to remember Karen and what she talked about, and that would be a great gift.
Our story about backyard gardeners selling their extra produce to grocery stores and restaurants bothered Pat Apperson of Pullman, Washington. She writes, every month there are tens of thousands of families in America, most often including children, who cannot feed themselves and would benefit greatly by the addition of fresh vegetables and fruit from gardeners. Excellent point. We called St. Mary's Food Bank Alliance in Phoenix, Arizona. It's the oldest food bank in the country. St. Mary's president and CEO Terry Shannon says the food bank movement actually got its start salvaging food from fields and backyard gardens.
It's a terrible thing to see food left in a field after a harvest because it didn't get picked up by the machines or the workers. Back in 1967, a gentleman by the name of John Van Hengel, who founded St. Mary's and is recognized internationally as the father of food banking, began with working with folks in the neighborhood and farmers to be able to accept food, surplus food from their fields, and getting it into the food bank and then out to those in need.
And in your part of the country, what kind of food is that?
You know, we are a produce-rich state in Arizona. Obviously, the citrus side of things is a very huge component. And if you take the lemons and oranges and grapefruits, this past growing season, we had 1.4 million pounds of those citrus items donated to us through the gleaning efforts of our community. So during that time, we're actually sending 3 to 4 semi-loads to sister food banks all over the West Coast. And in turn, we get their surplus during their harvesting season. And that could be potatoes out of Idaho, could be apples out of Washington. And it's a tremendous trade-off because it gives each of us variety and gives us the source of supply.
It's kind of like taking your extra produce over to your neighbor's house, but on a much
grander
higher
scale,
level.
Yeah,
much grander scale. So if our listeners have an embarrassment of zucchinis, an overwhelming amount of tomatoes, go to the local food bank.
Bring them down. Bring them down. We can absolutely put them to work in the community.
Terry Shannon, president and CEO of St. Mary's Food Bank Alliance in Phoenix, Arizona. Terry, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for the opportunity.
And you can find more about getting your extra produce to food banks. Just go to our website, weekendamerica.org. Drop us a line while you're there.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
I'm John Moe in St. Paul. If you've had Olympic fever the last 2 weeks, well, your temperature is about to go down. Tomorrow, the Olympic torch will be extinguished. The games will stop. No more medals. No more heartwarming stories. We will be Phelpsless. And fans of international contests in diving, beach volleyball, and trampoline will have to wait 4 years until the next summer games in London. It's going to be tough. I mean, what else compares to the Olympics? When else does the whole country go crazy for a swimmer? More importantly, what do Olympic junkies do now? One of our producers, Angela Kim, she has got it bad for the Olympics. She has been giving this a lot of thought.
Last weekend, I was at a bar in New York. The table next to me had about 8 people huddled around someone's iPhone. They were getting instant updates on Michael Phelps' last race. The entire room erupted, and that's when I knew that Phelps won his 8th gold medal. I'll miss moments like that, that camaraderie. I rarely watch sports, but every 4 years I make an exception for the Summer Olympics. But tomorrow, it'll all be over.
In a way, the Olympics are kind of every great television show rolled into one.
That's Whitney Matheson. She writes the pop culture blog Pop Candy, and she's been following the games.
You have drama, and you have great characters, you have competition. It's everything we love about television in this one compact season.
Whitney understands my addiction to the Olympics and my dread about what to watch when it's all over.
Yeah, it's a rough time because until the fall season, there isn't too much on TV. But my total guilty pleasure pick that I can't even really believe I'm talking about, but is Army Wives, which is, you know, you totally don't have to know what's going on in this show. You can jump in at any time. It's a drama. It's sort of like Desperate Housewives, but it won't leave you feeling dirty afterward.
It's not exactly what I'm looking for. I want something real, like the Olympics.
You know, I can't even like recommend really any reality show because the Olympics is the only reality style show that has any good in it. There's so many terrible ones out now. I don't know what's a really bad one that's on right now. There's that one called Hurl on like G4 where it's all people like competing to see who throws up first. It's horrible. You're going to be so let down.
An iron fist and an iron will. What a champ. Oh! On a scale of 1 to 5, that's a 3 bucket hurl.
Let's see it again.
Or not. My feeling of loss when the Olympics are over are purely selfish. I'm just a spectator watching it from a couch. I've been wondering how a former participant feels about it all. I called former Olympian and 1996 gold medal gymnast Shannon Miller. Yes, the Shannon Miller, part of the Magnificent Seven U.S. women's gymnastics team. She's lived the Olympics, but now she's watching it on TV. Well, sort of.
During the very first night of men's team finals, I couldn't sit still. So I finally got on my treadmill and started walking. I was scared I was going to jinx them, so I wouldn't watch the actual competition. I would wait till I heard the commentators calling the replay, and I'd watch the replay after they already finished. You know, I get ulcers watching these kids because it's nerve-wracking.
I feel the same way. Shannon loves watching the Olympics like me, but it can be a little too much.
Now, as a spectator, I sit on the edge of my seat, and I do. I feel like, you know, a mother that's anxiously awaiting, you know, her child to compete. And I know now how my parents must have felt. I think we're all kind of ready for a break.
Hey, not everyone. I'm not ready for a break. It's too soon. In the end, it's the stories that I'll miss, not so much the sports. Like the story about the Chinese women's gymnastic captain Cheng Fei. She sees her family only once a year because of her training and communicates with him through text messages. Her dad saves the texts that he gets from her. That story just broke my heart. And of course, there are all these little factoids I'll miss learning, like how Michael Phelps eats 3 egg sandwiches just for breakfast and consumes 12,000 calories a day. As I bid farewell to the Summer Olympics and deal with my Olympics withdrawal, I'll keep looking to fill that TV void, let's just hope that I don't have to hurl.
She pressed the barf button and triggered a gurgling geyser of creamed corn that she couldn't hold back.
Oh, my goodness. The closing ceremonies are tomorrow. To officially end the 17 days of events in Beijing and look ahead to London 2012, British singer Leona Lewis and Led Zeppelin's Jimmy Page are scheduled to perform. I guess that means we're now buying A Stairway to London. Now, the Beijing Olympics were the first to feature BMX bike racing, another thing that's going to be memorable about these games. Latvia took the gold in the men's competition. The U.S.